Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 25th, 2003. Today's session is entitled, The Leadership We Hunger For, Session 3, Leadership in the Guise of Mentor, presented by Dr. Sharon Parks, number Lens 2003-09. Let's listen in.
I want to say thank you also to all of the Holden Village staff and to the heritage of this place, that there is no question that it holds us in a special way as we do our work together and make something possible, I think, that might not be possible if we were sitting in a Hilton hotel. And I want to say again my gratitude to all the colleagues that I have worked with this week. And Chip, I think that you have been faithful to something you said early on when you said that if we are really committed and have a vocation, we should go to bed exhausted. I have watched you, and I have become convinced once again that the strength of ministry is sometimes dependent on the strength of metabolism. And Chip has not only given three presentations, but he preached his heart out last night. And we were blessed. And then you know he does this other thing, that while Paul and I are presenting, he's still working. He's here talking to us, you know? And I have been so blessed and held by that, and I have felt like I ought to do the same thing. But I know for a Quaker to sit there and try to pretend she knows how to do that, you know, just really isn't in the cards, you know. So I'm just deeply, deeply grateful for the varying ways we hold each other, but the way you do it is an enormous, enormous gift. When we first began our time together, and I was inviting us to reflect on the leadership we hunger for in the first time together, I spoke about the call to the new commons and to the common good and to adaptive leadership. In the second time that we were together, I spoke about formation in the alchemy of suffering and wonder. And now, here we are, the faithful remnant. All of the non-contemplatives are on the fast boat back. And here we are doing the work. And we're going to work hard in this remaining hour, because we're going to talk about a dimension of practice. It's one dimension of ethical leadership, and I'm suggesting that the practice is the practice of leadership in the guise of mentor. We live in a hinged time, and one of the features of the turbulence of this time is the extension of the lifespan. I was going to say we now can imagine living to be 100, Chip suggested 120. Two decades in the human lifespan that are particularly feeling the stress are the 20s decade and the 60s decade. Both of these decades are being given a double message by their society. If we are in our 60s, we are being told on one hand that this is the traditional time of retirement, that we should secure our financial support, hope that we have a few good years, and that now we can play and travel and so forth. On the other hand, we're being told that we may live another 30 years, and that there is a sense in which we should just have ramped up for a yet more profound era of contribution. Similarly, the 20s decade is being told, on one hand, you are going to live forever. This is a time for adventure. Don't sweat issues of job and career and so forth. You have time. And on the other hand, they are being given a message, you had better get in gear, be prepared to get yours in a world that is prepared to pass you by. Okay. Double messages coming. I want us to focus particularly on the 20-something decade. This is a more significant decade than is generally recognized in our society. In the 20s, people do many things. They may go to school to finish their GED and get their high school degree, or they may go to college or to graduate school or to professional school. It may be the time of first full-time job. It may be entry into a career. It may be a commitment that we call marriage, the commitment we call family. But I want to suggest that as important, as vital as all of these tasks are, that the central task of the 20-something era is the potential emergence of a new cognitive capacity that has enormous emotional and ethical implications. It is the potential, the possibility, the ripeness for the emergence of what we call critical thought, the capacity to step outside my own thought and wonder why I think that way. One way of telling the story of becoming adult is that there is an appropriate time in our growing up years when our faith, the way we make meaning in ultimate terms, can be understood in an authority-bound mode. You ask me what I believe, what I trust, why I believe it, why I trust it, and finally I will tell you about one or ones who have mediated that way of understanding to me. It may be my pastor, it may be my parents, it may be Time Magazine. But finally, there is some authority outside the self that I trust and that I depend upon. I have some sense that they read the tablets in the sky and they know what truth is. But then in the ongoing course of things, there may come a time when, as safe as that harbor may have been, I get curiouser and curiouser and I begin to wonder why things are construed the way they are, and I begin to push off of the dock and I go out into the deep water of wondering why for myself. And that's a kind of counter-dependent move. And, you know, it's complicated if you're a parent during that time because your child wants to do the opposite of whatever you suggest. And you get very clever, and so you suggest the opposite of what you want them to do. But on the other hand, they are very clever, and it's a good time to go to college or Tibet or someplace. And in that move, it's hard to live all of your life in a counter-dependent place, but we hate it when there are people on committees who are living in that place because we will never get to consensus. They will always have to be counter. But what happens finally is that I move to a place where I realize that I can't just trust authority out there. I can't just be counter to that authority. But rather, I have to let myself join the arena of authority. Not so much being independent, but having a new quality of interdependence. Being able to listen to the voice inside, knowing that I have some of the data that is vitally important to decisions that I must make on behalf of myself and on behalf of others. In that authority-bound place, it may be easy to be very clear about what is right and what is wrong, as Chip was speaking about it. But as one moves through a time of wondering why I think the way I think, and how I might think differently if I had grown up in a different family or a different country, a different way of seeing, then the questions of what is good and what is bad become more complicated, and they become scarier. But for the first time, one moves into the possibility of an authentic adult faith, because faith is finally only faith that can have a doubt of itself. Our faith has to be big enough to embrace our doubt. Our faith has to be a faith that finally dwells in the heart of the mystery, with a capital M, that we all share. The journey is not an easy one. Some of you may have had the privilege, as I have had, to study with Dick Niebuhr, Richard R. Niebuhr, the son of H. Richard Niebuhr, the nephew of Reinhold Niebuhr. If someone knew they were all going to be theologians, they should have used fewer R's in naming them. And he has said that we really don't adequately name the journey of faith if we don't describe it in part as a journey of shipwreck, gladness, and amazement. That over and over and over again, we are asked to relinquish our construal of certainty, and it unravels, but we find to our wonder that we wash up on a new shore of understanding and knowing and seeing and believing. And in that there is gladness, which he calls an intellectual affection, a new kind of knowing, and there is amazement. James Carroll long ago said that Easter and Passover are what happens to us when we look back and we say, I survived that. The 20s decade is a time that is ripe for a particular kind of shipwreck. And that shipwreck is this movement from authority-bound faith to a critically aware, seeing, knowing, believing, trusting in the journey we call life. There's a young woman who has written about this. Her name is Renee Lertzman, and she describes it this way. It was the day after our professor, Carlos Noreña, lectured on Kant that I felt something slipping away from me. I was in my dorm room looking out the window at the redwoods and the view of the Pacific Ocean beyond the knoll. I suddenly had the sense that I had no idea what was real and what wasn't and how to tell the difference. Under this new gaze, the chair, the table, the cup, all became questionable entities in the universe, each containing their own subjectivity, truth, and meaning. Coherency was elusive and beyond my grasp. How was I to know what was going on here? How could I continue to live, buy groceries, run errands, call friends, if I did not know? I went to Carlos's office that day and told him, I don't know what is real and what isn't. I'm thinking of dropping out of school to do organic farming. At least I know that growing carrots is real. We've all heard this one. Okay. He laughed and said to me in his thick Spanish accent, let's not do anything too drastic here. I suggest you take up swimming. And I don't think he even knew about the metaphor shipwreck, gladness, and amazement. Okay. Since that day, in my freshman year in college, I have felt a sort of waking up from sleepwalking through life. I was perplexed by my own catapult into wanting to know what life was about. Why was no one talking about this? It was when I left the college campus for an 8-week field study in the Sierra Nevada mountains studying nature, philosophy, and religion, that I began to locate this inquiry in the larger context of how we live among others, humans and non-human species. For 2 months, we lived in various wilderness areas. We walked between worlds, drinking the cold, clear waters of the mountains while making plans to return to the streets, lamps, steel, and glass. To step into wilderness is to see how complex our relationship with the ecological world is, and to see more clearly what we have determined as meaningful. The questions I was asking that first year in college did not go away. They only deepened, found new contexts and arenas. I had a professor once who jokingly called me ontologically insecure, like the people on the Star Trek holodeck. It is as if to question reality and living deeply can actually unhinge one's attachment to normative reality so as to occupy a space of always looking in. This sense of being ontologically insecure, I have come to see, is where I draw my strength. I have also come to see that to question and investigate life on the deepest levels possible is to walk on a rim of sorts. For me, the life worth living is to have the courage to be on the rim, to tolerate the space of not knowing and honor what is known. The rim, the place of knowing and not knowing. She continues, the people I look to as role models and teachers are those who live contemplatively, ask keen questions, and tolerate uncertainty. They thrive on the rim. Their minds are like diamonds, glittering with inquiry and beauty, deeply engaged in the world of the living. When one discovers that rim, where we know that we know and we don't know, and one discovers it for the first time, it is time for Yoda to show up. Mentor does not appear to take over your life and tell you what to do and what to become. Mentor appears because there is a process that I believe is the current of spirit moving through the becoming of human life that moves us in new ways, and mentor appears to provide good company and to give you confidence that you can make it through this transition from knowing to knowing that we know and we don't know. Mentor is there to be present to Renee as she discovers truth and vocation within a larger and more complex world. The word mentor is promiscuously used in our society. We talk about 5-year-olds having mentors. We talk about 55-year-olds having mentors. We talk about adolescents having mentors. I think there's a reason for this. We are looking for the naming of a relationship that is non-utilitarian. You can hire a teacher, you can hire a coach, you can hire various forms of assistance. You can't hire a mentor. A mentor comes out of another kind of chemistry. But at the same time that this word is overused in our society, the places where it should be used, it is increasingly under-practiced. Mentors should be there possibly from 17, 18, through the 20s to the later 20s, sometimes into the early 30s. Mentoring used to happen in more built-in organic ways. My favorite example is in a law firm, it used to be that the senior members of the firm would naturally serve as mentors to the younger junior members of the firm. But now we have a new kind of way of ordering our life in law firms, and two lawyers talking to each other is not a billable hour. And we are now two generations deep in lawyers who have not been mentored by their seniors. There is also an under-practicing of mentoring because in a tight economy, we set up a competition between the generations. And the older ones know that the younger ones are cheaper. And so there is a non-investment in mentoring in scary times. But if you are on the protege side, my friends, as we all know, it is easier not to make this journey and to remain comfortably dependent upon an authority-bound faith. What ends up taking the form that we often refer to, in some cases rightly, in other cases it's more complicated, as a fundamentalist faith that is unquestioned, that offers certainty in uncertain times. And it is possible to remain in that kind of faith for the whole of one's adulthood. But it is also possible that this turning into knowing and not knowing and holding life in a different way doesn't have to happen at 18 or 20 or 24. It can happen anytime in one's adulthood. And my partner, husband, colleague, Larry Delos, long before I met him, was teaching in programs in colleges that serve non-traditional students. These non-traditional students have now been in higher education for about 50 years, but we're calling them non-traditional students. Students who, for some reason, did not do their baccalaureate degree during that 18 to 22 or so period, but who come at a later time. And there are some programs that are set up as powerful mentoring places where the same kind of journey can happen. And I can say, he couldn't say it, but when I met him, he was writing what became an award-winning book, now titled Mentor, Guiding the Journey of Adult Learners. And I would be reading the account of Eric, but to be sitting in front of the author reading that wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. So I have asked Larry if he would come and read us the story of Eric.
This takes place in rural Vermont, where I would travel around to meet with students during the daytimes and discuss their study plans, help them design how they were going to create their degree plans. This describes a conversation with a young man named, well, not a young man, a man in his late 30s named Eric. He didn't used to be young anyway. And I'm meeting with him in the office of a small electronics firm where he works. And I called the vignette Into the Trenches. The walls are bare, beige, almost baleful. The table and chairs fit together perfectly with engineered elegance. Through the glass partition behind Eric, I can see people moving about the office space in utter silence, businesslike, correct, and very, very careful. We have met in the conference room of the small electronics firm where Eric works as an engineer to discuss his project for the adult development seminar that I'm teaching. Just over a year ago, fresh in the program, he and I sat in this very room and discussed his study plan. "I just want that piece of paper," he said back in that meeting, spiking me with a smile at once friendly and dead serious. "Look, I'll level with you. I've been in my current position long enough. I look around at some of the ding-a-lings that run this place, and I know damn well I can do better. But they've got that piece of paper, and I don't. So just tell me what I've got to do. Everything about Eric said precision, from his neatly trimmed hair to his perfectly kept loose-leaf notebook with every document and form in its place. For a long time after I met Eric, I would feel inordinately bumbling. Sure, I would trip over my briefcase, spill coffee on his registration form. Arriving 5 minutes late would find me trembling with guilt, angry at myself for leaving myself open to the judgment of his engineered intellect. Indeed, it was an application to which he freely turned his mind, sharply criticizing a current course at the community college as too unstructured. "Why don't they get someone to teach that stuff who knows what she's doing?" he complained. But in the months that followed, we warmed up considerably with each other. For all of his cross-grained irascibility, I found his candor refreshing. There was something deeper driving that honesty. Eric knew something about himself that didn't square with the man he showed at work. One day, curious about Eric's urgency to get ahead, I asked him about it. "Look," he said, "I've been spinning my wheels at this job for 10 years, and I just don't want to keep spinning anymore. I'm good at what I do. Damn good." He fixed me with that competent look again, and then turned to stare at the wall, as if trying to see outside, through it. "But I want to get doing what I want to do." "What's that?" "That's the trouble," came the reply evenly. "I don't really know. The only place I really feel good is when I'm out in the woods or fishing." And for the next half hour, Eric talked about his love for the outdoors, his skill as a bow hunter, his fascination with natural history, and his very considerable knowledge of local fish and game. "Why don't you study that?" "Hell," he shot back, "nobody pays you to do what you want to do." "They do me." "Sure, that's different. You've got all that education. You think I can afford to do that when I don't even have a degree? Besides," he added with a grin, "I couldn't live on what you're making." I laughed, somewhat bitterly, I'm afraid, and agreed with him. "Look," he said with a tinge of desperation, "I'm starting to feel a lot of pressure. Not just in my work, but in other areas as well. It's like I've got this biological clock inside me, and it's just ticking away. And I figure I've wasted all this time in my life, and I don't want to waste the second half of my life. I've lived almost 38 years, and I figure I'll live to be maybe 70. Then boom, that's it." It was clear that there was a good deal more turning in this engineer's mind than little wheels and a quest for a piece of paper. So over the following weeks, we explored a number of possible areas of study for Eric, other than simply more engineering. Although a complete shift to environmental studies was one such possibility, we both decided that that would be too drastic. As it turned out, during this time, Eric pressed for and received a promotion to a managerial position. As a result, he chose to shift his studies to industrial management. "More and more now, I'm working with people," he told me. "I need to learn more about what makes people tick." So that was how we ended up here, talking about psychology. "You know, reading this stuff is different from reading a math book," Eric is saying. "You have to pick and choose what's important." I grunt agreement. And he goes on, "It's like this organizational behavior tutorial I'm doing with Milt right now. We read a lot of case studies. At first, I kept looking for the right answer, the right way you're supposed to come out on each case. But as soon as I'd say what I thought, Milt would come out with another whole point of view I hadn't thought of. I'm beginning to get the idea that," as he says this, he grins knowingly at me, "I'm beginning to realize there's no single right answer. You have to try to put them all together and come up with the best approach. Predictably, my own grin answers his, and I respond with mock confusion. "But Eric, I thought you didn't like Milt. You said he was nothing but a wishy-washy college professor." "That's right," he bursts out. "He was, but now he's changed." "Must have been my influence," he adds, with conscious irony, and we laugh together. I remember that first study. Both Eric and Dave needed to study accounting, and I brought them together with Milt, a business instructor, in the hope that a strong bond would form among the three. It did, and although Eric listened with open skepticism to Dave's praise for liberal studies and fought Milt's discursive teaching style, it was fascinating to see how he was drawn back to Milt now, how the very same experience that he once thought too filled with bullshit and devoid of real content was becoming transformed into an experience he recalled with respect. "The thing about Milt," he continues, "is that he really helps you see that there are a lot of different points of view and that you have to try to make up your own mind for yourself about these things. There's no simple right or wrong answer when it comes down to dealing with people. Like, first there's the floor manager, then there's the boss, then there's the production workers and the union and all. I mean, in their own way, they're all right. Or wrong," he adds, chuckling. He goes on to talk about Milt, how shaken he has been by Milt's losing grapple with cancer. "He's come to mean an awful lot to me. You know, at first he didn't even want to take me on. He said he would only do it as a favor to you. But since then, we've gotten pretty close. He's shared a lot of things with me about his life, things I don't even really want to talk about." Eric stops and looks at his notebook, carefully framing it between his hands. "In a way, maybe it's just as well he is dying. Maybe I won't have a chance to see his warts." We are both silent a long time, avoiding each other's eyes. "Yeah," I say finally, "he's a rare man. He just won't let his condition get to him, will he?" Eric, who has been staring at the pale wall again, talks almost to himself. "You know, it's funny. This fall, during hunting season, I almost always get my deer the first day. This fall, I ran into a buck, a big buck, a 12-pointer. He stopped right in front of me, not 10 feet away. And we just looked at each other. Neither of us moved a muscle. We just stood there for a minute, 2 minutes, I don't know. Finally, he just turned and walked into the bushes. I never even lifted my bow. It's crazy. I don't know what's happening to me. Sometimes I'll put a fish back, even though it's big enough to keep." We're both silent again. Eric stares straight ahead, unmoving. At last I ask, "What's it about?" "You know, sometimes in your class I feel pretty dumb. When Susan and you get going about Jung and Freud and all those names I don't even know, I feel kind of shallow. Well, maybe so. Maybe I am shallow." He looks directly at me now, but there's no challenge there. Simple declaration. "But I've got deep trenches. But I've got deep trenches." I smile, moved by his honesty and eloquence. We both take a deep breath and straighten our chairs. "Well, we better finish up," he says, glancing at his digital watch. "I gotta get back." We discuss his presentation for a few minutes more and then pick up to leave. He opens the door for me as I go out, and I remark that I hope I won't get a ticket for parking in an executive parking space. "I hope it wasn't yours," I say, "now that you're a fat cat." "Hell, you'll never catch me parking in one of those places," he replies, the familiar grin back. "Oh, why not?" "You wouldn't believe this place," he snorts. "It's like a bunch of baboons. They all scrap for the parking place closest to the boss. Regular pecking order. Same thing in meetings. Number three man has to sit next to number two man. Number two man has to sit next to number one man. It's a crock. Then he sticks out his hand, grinning broadly. Thanks. I return the handshake, but drive off feeling vaguely empty. In another place, another time, I'd have hugged him just then.
The journey into new ways of seeing and being takes many forms, and it happens best in the company of mentor. But now I want to say what may be the most important thing given to me to say. I have come to believe that if we are going to be mentored into the discipline or the corporation or the church or whatever job as we now know them, a mentor is a gift, and a mentor will be enough. But if we are going to be mentored into a given position, into a corporation, into a discipline, into the church, as they could become, a mentor will not be enough. What we are seeing is that what seems to be required is not simply a mentor, but a mentoring environment, or better, a mentoring community. You and I are profoundly social creatures, and if I am going to take the road less traveled by, I need to have confidence that it's not going to just be me and my mentor out there, but there's going to be an us, there's going to be a we. And we have seen in our study of Common Fire that many people who appear in later life to look like they really have what it takes to stand alone and exercise that moral courage that Paul Simon called for over and over and over again. And they look like they are standing against the tide alone. When we excavate their history, we find that in their young adult years, they were a part of a mentoring community. And they have a deep sense in their gut that they are not working alone, that there are others whom they know and who they don't know, who are working also on behalf of an alternative, more prophetic vision, purpose, possibility. So what are the hallmarks of a mentoring community? Well, they're the hallmarks of good mentors. And I want to suggest that there are four primary hallmarks. The first one is that a mentor or a mentoring community recognizes you, both as you are now, but also has some capacity to see who you might become. We found in doing our study in Common Fire that one of the good questions to ask people as we were trying to understand their formation was to ask the question, who saw you? Who saw you? This account was given to me in another context by a now senior minister who tells this story. Attending a youth conference as a young minister to youth, I was in awe of some of the other ministers present. Men and women who I respected, they were inspirations to me in my ministry. One morning, one of these men came up and said, "I would love the privilege of getting together with you. How about over a Coke this afternoon?" I couldn't believe what I had heard. This successful, highly regarded man wanted to sit down with me. With me? Why? I felt both honored and scared. Why would he want to take this time and spend it with a young youth minister? That afternoon, we did get together and had a great time getting to know each other. I can't recall all that this man shared with me, but I do remember one statement he made that has stayed with me as a real source of encouragement. As our conversation came to a close, He looked straight into my eyes and he said, "Michael, I want to tell you something. This afternoon, I'm buying stock in you as a person and as a minister. Right now, as you begin your ministry, the stock is not at a high. But one day, the stock in you is going to pay big dividends, and I'm buying into it right now because I believe in you." There was a man with years of successful ministry, not yet knowing me closely, yet willing not only to sit down with me, but also willing to risk himself. He said, "I believe in you right now as you begin, even as you experiment and as you grow." That afternoon, I walked alone among the pines and I prayed, "What is this all about? What can the words of this good man mean? Were they words from you? Were they inspiration, encouragement you knew that I needed to hear? Will the stock pay off? And will there be dividends down the road?" Now, years later, this incident, along with many others, brings to mind the realization that God placed certain people in my life to be a source of encouragement and support, both to my ministry and to me personally. That story has particular power for me. It was given to me after my father's death, and the mentor is my father. My stepdaughter told us this. She teaches mostly immigrant students wanting to get their GED, and she teaches in Queens, living in Brooklyn, New York. And she says this: "In general, I get excellent support from all the other teachers in that they listen to my theories and ideas as much as to each other's, even though I have, in some cases, 10 or more years less experience than they do. My boss comes to me for ideas, shares his ideas with me, and has on occasion used my worksheets with his class. He has really made me feel like a peer, even though I am closer to his children's age than to his. He and I are teaching the same level class right now in the same time slot. So we've entered the semester trying to figure out some curriculum we could work out jointly. He has chosen a book that I have suggested, even though he hasn't finished reading it yet. He has agreed to teach it based on my advice. His support is really, really encouraging and has made me feel very welcome at the school. He has prepared me to lead my classes, backed me up when I'm frustrated. Basically, it's like being a real part of the team. I guess the very nature of that interaction makes me feel like I am an adult." Who saw you? Who saw you? The second hallmark of a good mentor and mentoring environments, after the first one of recognition, is support. Support takes many, many forms. We notice that in those I have already described, that you can hear in the background that there is a network of belonging and community that is holding them. A young woman in her senior year at university, talking with her aunt, said, "One of my current unresolved questions is that I don't know where to tie my spirit into. There are confines and dangers of different religions. Yet religion provides a place of community and hope like no other." One of the questions we can ask ourselves is, do we in our congregation serve as mentoring communities for young adult souls? And I want to suggest that the form of community can take three broad forms here. One, I think that there is a hunger among young adults not for appointments with us, but rather there is a hunger for hearth. There is a hunger for that kind of fireside conversation, wherever it may take place, that may be on the one-to-one, it may be with some in a small group, but it begins as it happens and it ends whenever. It is marked by shared questions. and it allows for times of silence and pause. It is not hurried, but it goes deep, and it is going deep into the trenches. Another form that I think it takes is the form of table, which is an extension of hearth. It is a place of dialogue. It is also a place of shared vulnerability and shared accountability. Mentoring communities provide home between home and home, between the home the young adult has had and the home the young adult will later create. And if we're realistic, it includes food. It includes the attraction of a good meal that we gather around and that holds us in our becoming. The young adult years, for those who have been notably wounded, is a time of finding a surrogate family. Across our colleges and universities, we are having to come to terms with the fact that we are receiving a more wounded generation. We have a very high percentage of young adults coming into higher education who are on drugs that have been prescribed for them, medications to deal with emotional, spiritual concerns. We have vulnerable young adults looking for a home place between homes. And there has been some wonderful documentation in a book on resilient adults of the power of those places that serve as surrogate family, where I begin to be able to move from the ultimacy of the family I have known, can begin to get perspective on that with both grief and gratitude, and can find a place of relativizing that and claiming a new possibility of family and belonging that can be healing instead of wounding. Hearth, table, and commons. There is a hunger in the young adult years, a ripeness for belonging, for a network of belonging to something larger than the self. In our society today, the church is uniquely positioned to provide hearth, table, and commons for the 20-something years. Yet we tend to identify that generation as one notably absent from many of our congregations. Now to come to hallmark number three. Mentors and mentoring communities do a very fancy two-step. While providing recognition and support, we also provide challenge. One form of challenge is big enough questions. Now, why do I say big enough questions? I had the privilege some years ago of being invited during the last round of scandals to work with the Harvard Business School as they were readdressing ethics in the curriculum. And as I had the privilege of interviewing, entering MBAs and then exiting MBAs, people getting their Masters of Business Administration, I found that these young adults, all in their 20s, tended to be very bright, talented, and many would say privileged. But I found that not all, but many, many of these young adults had been fundamentally cheated. They were already held hostage to certain lifestyle choices when no one had privileged them with the questions of vocation, the deeper questions of their own becoming. And so I came to think about big enough questions, and it became finally the title of the book, Big Questions and Worthy Dreams. This list of questions is in that book, so don't bother to take notes. But what are some of the meaningful questions that ultimately matter that young adults ask? And as I suggest these, I want to remind us that Paul Simon suggested that we may need to have some sermons that are only questions. Questions young adults ask: who do I really want to become? How do I work towards something when I don't even know what it is? Am I lovable? Who will be there for me? Why is suffering so pervasive? What are the values and the limitations of my culture? Who am I as a sexual being? Do my actions make any real difference in the bigger scheme of things? Do I want friendship, partnership, marriage? If so, why? With whom? What is my society or life or God asking of me? Anything? What is the meaning of money? How much is enough? Is there a master plan? Am I wasting time I'll regret later? What constitutes meaningful work? How have I been wounded? Will I ever really heal? What do I want the future to look like for me, for others, for my planet? What is my religion? Do I need one? What are my real talents, preferences, skills, and longings? Where can I be creative? What am I vulnerable to? How am I complicit in the patterns of injustice? Will I always be stereotyped? Do I want to bring children into the world? How do I discern what is trustworthy? Where do I want to put my stake in the ground and invest my life? These are questions of meaning, purpose, and faith, and they are rightly asked in every generation, in young adulthood and throughout adult life. But there are also big questions that are particular to our time in history. Why is there a growing gap between the haves and the have-nots? Why is the prison population growing so dramatically in the United States? Why are antidepressants being prescribed for increasing numbers of children? These are questions about the relationship of self and world, and when we are younger, we can defer these questions to others. But becoming adult means increasing capability and responsibility for our participation in the life of the commons and our own knowledge and action. These are questions of consequence that cannot be simply ducked as irrelevant or not my concern. Such questions require systemic thought, seeing the complex connections among things. And here I want to underscore that what we are reaching for here is the possibility of the emergence of not only critical thought, but the capacity for a new quality of connective thought, connecting the dots. This move from authority-bound critical thought corresponds with the move from a merely interpersonal way of construing morality alone to a systemic ethical way of seeing and responding. What do I mean? When I was interviewing the students at Harvard Business School, near the end of the interview, I would say to them, "You have told me a lot about what you hope for, what you aspire to." Usually they wanted to become a major role in a significant large company, or they wanted to create a significant business of their own. And I would say, as you think across all the years ahead, who or what do you think you may or might hurt? Now, most of us don't go around making plans in these directions, and so I would give them a little time. And usually they would look back at me rather blankly, and then usually they would kind of shrug and say, "Well, I hope I won't hurt anybody." Now, given what they had told me they wanted to do, I wanted to say, "You're kidding." But being a good social scientist, I would give them a little more time. And then they would typically look back at me and say, "Well, I might have to hurt my family." We are offering careers where our young adults believe they are going to have to hurt those they love the most if they're going to be successful. I would give them a little more time, and then they would say, well, I might have to fire someone. And you had the feeling that they were sitting on one side of the desk, delivering the bad news to someone on the other side of the desk. In contrast, we interviewed a corporate lawyer in Boston, committed to the common good, and she said, I work here because every day I'm working with people who can affect thousands of lives with merely the signature on a page. She is able to do critical, systemic, connective thought. When I was teaching a little while back, as I do in the executive leadership program at Seattle University, I was working with a cohort of managers who in mid-career were having a chance to sit back and have contemplative time. And I was talking about the importance of otherness and encounters with otherness. And at the end of each section of the module, I have them take a 4x6 card, and I ask for their IQ. I say, would you write on one side of the card an insight from what we've been talking about in this section? And on the other side, would you write a question that has come from our conversation together? And then I flip through these cards during the break to find out where in the world they are, and then we enter into the next module. Well, we were breaking for lunch. I collected the cards, and they had left the room. And I read this person's card, and this person is African-American. He had already presented his own case. He's clearly been given major responsibility in one of the largest firms in the Northwest, and he has clearly been very successful. And what he wrote on his card was this: I have so very much pain for racism in America that I don't feel American. I did not experience a heightened sense of patriotism after September 11th, as many speak of. The constant discrimination and racist messages I receive on a daily basis has my full attention on just survival. I am afraid for my children and don't have much desire to facilitate a commons in the place where I work. It's like a very famous song states, I can't make you love me if you don't. I am sad to admit I have given up. The question on the other side of the card was, is my position or thoughts healthy? My most important issue is to educate and prepare my children. I made my way to the dining hall, and he hadn't sat down yet, and I was able to talk with him personally, and I said, I appreciate so much what you wrote on your card. When we return to the classroom, would you be willing to share it with the class? He said he would think about it. When we got back to class, I looked at him, and he shook his head no. And so it was on me. And without disclosing what he had said, I tried to speak as faithfully to the reality that he had spoken of as I could. I don't remember what I said, but when I finished, he put up his hand and said, I'll talk. And then he told his colleagues what he had told me on the card. And he said, I'm worried for my son. He said, he's better than I am. And he said, I'm afraid he's going to end up in the wrong place without an alibi. And everyone leaned forward. You could feel it. Everyone wanted to say, your son is going to be okay. And no one could say it, because we were not just dealing with interpersonal morality. We were dealing with a systemic morality. And they could not reassure him until our system is changed. When we talk about the potential of what is possible in human becoming in the young adult years of new ways of seeing, knowing, and being, we are talking about a vital transition in the ethical life. And there has just come out a study that has explicitly looked at whether those in more fundamentalist congregations are able to see the systemic issues in racism. And the findings, not surprising, are that there is an interpersonal ethic but there is not a systemic ethic in place. One of the ways that Patricia Killen has put it, she said, in many of today's churches, we offer a theology of baptism, the relationship between me and God, between me and Jesus, but we do not offer a theology of the table, of our relationships with each other and how they are brought into God's harmonic. The fourth characteristic or hallmark of a mentoring community, mentors, good mentors, inspire. Years ago, Daniel Levinson said that the other task of the young adult years is the formation of a dream with a capital D. Mentors mediate or point the way to worthy dreams or what you and I would call vocation. Probably many of you share with me my favorite definition of vocation, drawn in part from Buechner, that vocation is the place where the heart's deep gladness meets the world's deep hunger. And there are six characteristics of such a dream, someone has said. I wish I could give credit, but I don't know where I got it. The first is, does it enliven me? Does it give me energy? Second, does it align with my core values? Three, to realize it, do I need help from God? If you can do it by yourself, it's only a goal. It's not a dream with a capital D. It's not a vocation. Will it require me to grow into more of my true self? And will it take a lifetime to do that? Will it ultimately bless others? And then one that someone I was speaking with added, can I step out on it? Is it something that I can really do? Is it something that makes it possible for me to take a step that will make other steps possible? You remember when Chip was talking about the pessimist steps back, the optimist says, I'm going to take a step, and it was the peptimist or something that says, I'm going to step out on this. It's that kind of dream that we're talking about. Paul Simon asked us over and over again to think about the formation of leadership in terms of the formation of moral courage. I know a young man whose grandfather is a minister, whose parents are deeply involved in the life of the church and issues of justice. He is now working in a bank, a major bank in New York City, a Wall Street bank, and he has the aspiration that someday in the financial world he will be able to serve developing countries in ways that are just and good. But he's there as a 20-something. And when I asked him about the practice of ethics in that context, because I was going to be speaking for a group of deans of business schools, he said quietly, it's all won or lost in the gray. There aren't easy, clear rights and wrongs here. It's all won or lost in the gray. And then he shared his own experience. He said that an older man in the bank talked with him and another one who was younger in the bank and asked them if they thought they were going to be asked to do a certain activity. And this young man says it was something that didn't really pass the smell test. You wouldn't want to be called into a Senate hearing, and it was something that might bring you into a Senate hearing. And they said they thought they were probably going to be asked to do this. And then the older man said, do you think it would jeopardize your standing in the bank if you refused? And they said they thought it would. And the older man simply conveyed his sadness that they perceived the culture of the bank to be that way. As a consequence, this young man did refuse to do that. But he tells me, even in light of this wonderful background, he would have done it if he had not had the conversation with the older member in the bank. A mentoring presence. Moral courage and how it is formed in the 20-something decade when the antenna are out in a whole fresh way. for what will be asked and allowed. Moral courage. When I was associate chaplain at Whitworth College, there was a young man who he never made an appointment, but he often breezed through my office. And his name was Scott. And we had an ongoing conversation. And I thought I knew Scott very, very well. And graduation day came, and I met his father. And his father had severe burns on his face and arms, and I imagined elsewhere on his body. And after graduation was over, and Scott was still around packing up, and I said, Scott, I said, how was your father burned? Scott looked at me as if I just stepped off another planet, and he said, I never told you about the fire. I said, what fire? And Scott and I had known each other so well, he thought, I knew. This is one of these humbling moments for counselors when we think we know. I had talked with Scott a lot about whether or not he was going to take over his father's business. And Scott was resisting this. And I thought I knew the father-son relationship. What I didn't know was that there had been a fine morning when Scott's dad and Scott's dad's best friend had been going out on the helicopter to look at the ranches in Montana. And they asked Scott if he wanted to come along, and Scott said he didn't think he would that day. And when the two men went to land the helicopter, it wouldn't land, and the pilot forced the stick, and it landed, but it burst into flames. Scott's dad was thrown out, but he realized that his friend was still inside, and he went back into the flames, pulled his friend out, but both men were dramatically burned, flown to Mayo Clinic. The friend died. Scott's father lived, but by the time, months later, when he could return home, he still had to be lifted in and out of the bath, and Scott was the member of the family strong enough to do that. I thought I knew something about the relationship between this father and this son. I didn't know very much at all. What is important to me about that story is it tells us how courage really works. People usually say, I wasn't courageous, I just did what made sense, what needed to be done. And when we are courageous, it's because we see a reality that is different from what others are seeing. And what Scott's father was seeing was not the flames. He was seeing his friend on the other side of the flames. And that's how he could act in a way that we call courageous. And so what is being asked of us as mentoring communities is, what reality do we mediate? And I am finding myself now, for the first time in all the times that I have talked about this, to feel that I cannot close without saying something about movements. And I do have a little bit in the book about it. And it reads thusly, movements take us into new ways of seeing, knowing, trusting, and faithing. And one way that young adults find a sense of meaning and purpose and develop critical, self-aware, and responsible faith is through participation in social movements. The reach for the ideal and a place of meaningful contribution in the adult world uniquely positions the energy of young adults to serve as vital fuel for the transforming social movements, as it also makes young adults vulnerable to the exploitation of false mentors and movements who lead to death rather than to life. Not every generation has an opportunity to be a part of a great social turning, but those who do tend to feel in later life a kind of privilege in having had one's adulthood forged in the fire of social conflict and in the service of high purpose. Wherever there is a groundswell of resistance to injustice and a stirring of the collective conscience, we can count on young adults to show up. The movement itself becomes a mentoring community, as critical dialogue, productive conflict, powerful images, a host of mentors, a call to action, and a public stage upon which to test one's powers create a confluence of recognition, support, challenge, and inspiration, a crucible for the formation of young adult faith. It might be said that until we achieve a just and sustainable Earth community, every generation of young adults deserves access to a worthy social movement. Movements are inevitably messy as well as meaningful, and they have their own kind of casualties. But it must be acknowledged that in the context of a great movement, many young adults discover purposeful participation in something larger than the self and gain access to worthy dreams. A young African American, now a religious leader, told us of his experience in the civil rights movement. And he says, if the black teachers and professionals in my community saw a young person who had talent and ability, they wouldn't let you stop. From them, I learned the role of black professionals and intellectuals in the struggle. I saw the importance of having people who could strategize, who could see the larger picture, the institutional relationships. I actually got to sit in on some of the strategy sessions, and they were analyzing the political situation and seeing whose interests were at stake and looking at the black community to see where we could engender support. I asked to be allowed to do it, and I was encouraged. It was just so important to be there because I had to know that somewhere people weren't just being beaten down and just taking it on the chin. There was a thinking group that looked ahead and said, this is what we've got to do next. I had to be a part of that for my own sanity. One began to see that there was a cadre of leaders and thinkers who saw far beyond my city and connected us with what was going on around the world and around the United States, so one didn't feel so powerless. I have just begun to direct a new initiative called Leadership for the New Commons. And at the first small consultation that was gathered to begin to talk about that, there was a young man, bright, talented, in his later 20s, who was animated by the essential idea. And he said to all of us, is this going to be a movement? Now, I must admit that there was a voice in me that said, oh no, just an initiative. In Hinge Time, that gentle, restless spirit we sang about is moving us from an equilibrium that isn't good enough, it isn't just enough or sustainable enough, to more faithful ways of living. 100 years ago, last Sunday night, when the speakers were gathered together, hosted by Bob, in a restaurant in Chelan, one of our numbers suggested that maybe we live in a time when we as Americans can't do so much and others are going to have to do things. And Chip spoke up and he said, but this week could make all the difference. Chip walks around, apparently, with the expectation that spirit is brewing a movement. It has been said that next to a banjo, the most powerful tool is a story, and that the 21st century will belong to those who can tell and write the most powerful story. Our young people, it was noted in one of the fireside conversations, don't seem so much to want to hear our story of Jesus and us simply as told in the first, 16th, and 20th centuries. I suspect they are ripe for being attracted to powerful stories being written now through the lives of our congregations. In Hinge Time, there is a call for leadership to appear in part in the guise of mentorship, worthy of the promise of young adults who are dependent upon our faithfulness, and worthy of the imagination of our God, who is faithful in every time. Thank you.